Good to have all of you here this evening. We're going to continue with our study in Genesis. We'll be beginning about the 13th chapter. And we're going to sort of pick up where we left off before the summer series. Let's just get a little bit of a background before we, a recap before we get on into chapter 13. Genesis generally can be divided into three sections, and we've basically completed the first one. That constitutes the creation and the flood, and then the aftermath on up to Abraham. And then we begin the building of the kingdom of Israel, which of course leads to the kingdom of God, kingdom of Christ. And so that we are now about ready to begin the second section of the life of Abraham. We caught up. Well, let's catch up with Abraham. Beginning with the flood, of course, all mankind was wiped out in the flood except for Noah's family. And so all of us, the little kid's song, red and yellow, black and white, all of us are descended from those three men. And so no matter what our ethnicity is, if it were possible, we could all trace our ancestry back to one of Noah's sons. So Noah's father, Terah, was 10 generations from Noah. It's not necessarily important that we know every one of those men in between. There's very little said about them. Other than they lived so many years, they had sons and daughters, and then died, and those verses are just repeated over and over again, just changing the names. And so we come to Terah then, who was the father of three sons, and Abram, Nahor, and Haran. We don't know which was older or younger. We're not told that. So it really, I don't know that it makes a whole lot of difference. We do know that Haran died apparently relatively young. Of course, back at that day and time, I don't know exactly what dying young would be. He might have been 50, 60, or 70 years old. And that might have been considered young at that particular time. But anyway, he died much earlier than the other two brothers. We don't know really much about Nahor. We know that he stayed in Ur of the Chaldees. That's about all that we know about him. So the scriptures center upon Abraham and his journeys and then his descendants. So beginning on this map and following the red line, that's basically the journey of Abraham from his homeland, which is in the bottom right-hand corner of the screen there, Ur of the Chaldees, which is in present-day Iran, just to give you a sort of a picture of the area that we're talking about. Then Terah and Abraham and Lot and their families all left Ur of the Chaldees and went up to Haran. Now, I'm not sure, we're not told, and archaeologists have really not done much or come up with much information either. about Haran, it's probably named after Abram's brother that died relatively young. So that's a place that they stopped for some period of time. We know at least 5 years they stayed there. That's where Terah died. And so that left Abram, Sarah, Lot, and their possessions. We don't know where Lot picked up his wife, whether he had her at this time or whether she was from one of the areas that they traveled through. We're just not told. About all we know about her is she turned a block of salt a little bit later on. So anyway, they stayed at Haran for at least 5 years because we're told that Terah stayed there, and after 5 years he died. And so they left there and then went down through what we would call the Promised Land, which would be Canaan or present-day Israel. I didn't mention Haran is in present-day Turkey. So he made basically a journey through much of what we refer to today as the Middle East, and going from Iran to Turkey to Israel. And then from Israel, he spent some time there in Canaan, around the area of Hebron, Shechem, Ai, Mamre, that relatively small area. We'll talk about the areas in just a minute. But in that relatively small area, we don't know how long he stayed there exactly. Not very long the first time, because they were forced out by famine. And then from there, he continued as the arrow goes there down into Egypt. And he spent some time in Egypt. This was one of the times, there were actually two of them that occurred, where Abram lied. And it's just an outright lie. And yet he is referred to as the father of the faithful. So that should give us some hope, I guess. Just like David is considered, God even calls him a man after my own heart. And so those are two flawed individuals, yet they are some of the bedrock, the foundations of the kingdom of Israel, and then later on the kingdom of Christ or kingdom of God, the church. And so, if they were considered good examples, even being as flawed as they were, that's why we know that we can still be acceptable to God, even though we're not necessarily perfect. It is our goal to try to be as perfect as possible, but being humans, that's almost an impossible task. I only know of one person who was ever able to accomplish that, and that was Jesus himself. But that at least is our goal. Sometimes we hear that phrase, Christ's perfect pattern. Well, that was because he lived a human existence. He was tempted in all ways as we are, and yet he was without sin. So it can be done, but it would obviously take more than most of us are capable of doing. But anyway, in Egypt, the lie that I had reference to was that Abram told the Pharaoh that Sarah, or Sarai, was his sister. And genealogically, she was a sister, half-sister. And so that may not have been exactly a lie, but it was a lie by omission that she was not, or that she was actually his wife. So that simply being human frailty. Abram, being as close to God as he was still overcome with some of the same fears and temptations that we are. And that was, he was afraid for his life because he was afraid of what Pharaoh might do if he desired to make Sarah one of his wives or his harem. And if Abram had admitted to being her husband, Pharaoh may have just had him done away with and taken her. So in this particular instance, the Pharaoh was a little bit more upstanding than Abram gave him credit for. And when he found out, when Pharaoh found out the truth, he asked Abram, you know, why did you lie to me? And Abram told him his fears. So anyway, the Pharaoh gave Abram provisions and that kind of thing, but basically kicked him out of the country. He didn't want him there, especially after having died. I mean, lied. And so basically that's where we are. That's where we got to. And are ready now to begin chapter 13. Pharaoh has told Moses, Pharaoh has told Abram to leave the country and to go back home. Now, his home is right up in that area, somewhere around Bethel. Ai has a question mark beside it because we don't know exactly where that is. Just to give you a point of reference, from Ai to Jericho is less than a day's journey. So just walking across there would take less than a day. So we're not talking about a huge distance. But somewhere in that vicinity is where his home was. So he was, as in verse 1 of chapter 13 says, Abram went up from Egypt to the Negev. And that's, you can see on the map there, that pointed area there where the word Negev desert is. That's basically the end of the present-day country of Israel. And the Negev basically just means wilderness. And so he went back from Egypt through that area and was on his way back up to Canaan, where he had spent some time previously. Verse 2 tells us that Abram was very rich in livestock and gold and silver. Now, one of the things that caused trouble a little bit later was the amount of livestock that he had. Lot also had a great deal of livestock. And one of the things we have to remember, even here in Alabama, where it's relatively lush, or is lush, compared to the Middle East, it requires approximately 2 acres per head of cattle in order to sustain that animal. And so if you had 100 head of cattle, obviously that would require 200 acres or so. So if you get into the thousands, which later on, that's actually the numbers that were talked about. But that was not just cattle. It also included sheep. It also included goats. It also included horses. Besides the provisions for all the people that was necessary in order to maintain that household or that, I don't know exactly what you call it, that family, extended family, and their possessions. So it would have taken a lot of acreage. Now, over there, where the grazing and all that kind of stuff is much less adequate than it is here, obviously it would take more area to sustain each head of livestock than it would here. So we can understand why there was going to be a problem in verse 5. After Abram had basically gone home, he built an altar, which was one of his things to do. Just about every important event in his life is associated with some kind of altar or some kind of offering. And so this is the case here. After he returned home, in verse 5, Lot was with him, and he also had flocks and herds and tents. So he had the livestock, and he also had the tents, would represent the people that were needed to care for all those animals. And so he also had great possessions. And as verse 6 says, the land couldn't stand it. There were just too many things for that particular amount of land to sustain. And so there got to be a division or a strife between Abram and Lot's herdsmen. Both, I'm sure, were trying to secure the best areas for their masters or their bosses. And that would have also included water, which would be a great commodity in that part of the world as well. Anyway, they got to a point where they just couldn't sustain themselves anymore. I forgot to show you that picture. That's a picture of the Negev as it exists today in the very southern tip of Israel. I thought it was right interesting that Abram didn't have, wasn't able to stop in at McDonald's and have a Big Mac, but you could if you went over there today. In that same area, there is a McDonald's. So, anyway, after their conflict, they were in this area here, and so Abram told Lot, said, "You look around and you pick." Abram, of course, being the older and the more influential, probably richer, even though Lot was not poor by any means, Abram should have had the position of authority, being Lot's uncle. So, but anyway, he did the magnanimous thing and gave Lot the choice. And so Lot lifted up up his eyes, and he looked around, and he chose what he considered the best, and he chose the Jordan Valley. And this particular picture, the Jordan Valley is that gray area with the Jordan running right up the middle of it. That doesn't necessarily indicate vegetation or anything. This map indicates elevation. So the green is basically sea level, the yellow is above sea level, and the gray is below. It doesn't have anything to do with the vegetation or anything. But I couldn't really find a better map than that. But just think of that valley around on either side of the Jordan being very green for that part of the world. Probably looked very much like it does around here on the banks of the Tennessee River. But Lot decided that he was going to take the area of the Jordan Valley, and the two places that are circled there are Sodom and Gomorrah. And we will learn of them or find out more about them shortly. But that's the area that Lot took to possess. And then Abram said to have taken the high ground, and he would be in the area on the left side of the screen with the red circle, up in the hill country of Canaan. And so they split their possessions, and they just took their leave of each other to avoid problems. Little did Lot know of the kind of problems that were going to come up because of the area that he chose. All of us know the story of Sodom and Gomorrah. Sodom, one of the wickedest areas that are known. We even have the word has come into our laws and that kind of thing. Some of the most terrible sexual perversions are sodomy, and someone called a sodomite and that kind of thing, all having reference to various forms of sexual perversion. But anyway, that we'll come back to that a little bit later. Verse 14, now Abram has finally separated himself from family and friends and all that kind of thing. Back in Ur of the Chaldees, God told him to separate yourself from your family and go to a land that I will show you. Well, this is basically a repeat of that same promise here in verse 14. The Lord said to Abram, after Lot had separated himself, now lift up your eyes and look from the place where you are, northward and southward and eastward and westward. So, in other words, if you can see there where that red circle is on the left side of the screen, he said, you're in the high country. Look around as far as you can see. All of that's yours. And so, last part of verse 15, I will give it to you and to your descendants forever. Now, we know later on, God repeated this same promise to Joshua and the Israelites when they went in to repossess the land, but he put some qualifications on it, just like us. He says, I'll save you from your sins, but there are certain things you're going to have to do in order to get that salvation. It's not just, I'm just going to give it to you. You can't just say, I want it, and that's all it's going to take. So, in the same place here, he told him, God told Abram that you're going to have to leave your family and your country and your home and go to where I show you. And remember, at that very first time that the promise was made, Abram had no idea where he was going. God didn't say, I'm going to take you to Turkey and then I'm going to take you on over to Israel, or whatever they called them back then. But he just said, I'm going to show you a place. And so now he's showing it to him. He's saying, this is the place. This is what I promised you before. And now that you've left all of your ties behind, then this is that promise I'm going to make to you. Verse 16 goes on with another part of the promise, and I will make your descendants. Now remember at this time, and Colin mentioned that a minute ago in the Devo, that Noah, Abram, and Sarai had no children at this particular point in time, but God tells him, I will make your descendants as the dust of the earth, so that if anyone can number the dust of the earth, then your descendants can also be numbered. Now, both of them at this point in time were approaching 100 years old. Even at that time, apparently, that was beyond childbearing age. But anyway, God told him in verse 17, arise, walk about the land through its length and breadth, for I will give it to you. And so Abram moved his tent in verse 18, and came and dwelt by the oaks of Mamre, which are in Hebron. And there he built an altar to the Lord. And again, here is an important milestone in Abram's life. And what does he do but build an altar? So again, Abram is associated with the worship of God from the very, very beginning. And we're going to see some other instances of that as we get into chapter 14. Anybody have any question about chapter 13? Well, the Sodom and Gomorrah are not destroyed for another four or five chapters. That's all it meant. Those cities were there a long time before Lot. Yeah, I assume that it did. Now, I don't know what may have caused the change. As close to the flood, the climate may have still been changing back at that time. I'm just not sure. We do know that there was, after the flood, there was a period of time where climate was just in flux. It was just all over the place. And many of the experts in that area think what most people refer to as an ice age. That's when that occurred, was in that period of time right after the flood, where there was very little vegetation on the ground and really nothing to hold the heat and that kind of stuff. So that may have been the case, but I assume that at this point in time there was a good water source. Now, if you remember, I think we talked about this. I don't remember when now, but anyway, let's just mention it. Egypt has most all of their growing occurs in the Nile River and on the banks of the Nile River and the Nile Delta, and we think here of watering, and we think of it coming from the sky. Well, obviously it does there too, but their watering is not the same. Almost all the watering of the farms of Egypt and Israel and in that same area are done by flooding, where there are rains in the mountains, and then the floods or the water comes down and fills up the Nile River, and so all of the Nile Delta and the surrounding Nile River Valley are watered by flood, and they depend on that. And they have their farming schedules and all that kind of stuff based on the floods, not on the seasonal rains and that kind of thing, because there are some areas over there that are like some areas of Australia where it may be 3 years between rains, but the water comes from some other place and is a type, I guess you'd call it, a type of irrigation that they use. So it may have been the same way at that time as well, that their watering was not necessarily rain. It may have been some other source of some type of irrigation or something. Yes.
Oh.
That's correct. Good point, Gene. Yeah, anything else about chapter 13? All right, in chapter 14, we have a war. And one of the things that, if you don't know a little bit of the background, it sounds a whole lot worse than it actually was. Now, these are the combatants. On the left are the four kings from the north. And then on the right are all of the kingdoms and the tribes. Some of those ones at the top were city-states or kingdoms. And the ones on the bottom under the plus sign, those were basically tribal peoples or nomadic people. And so all of them occupied the southern area around the bottom, southern end of the Dead Sea. And those are the areas that we're talking about. Those four northern kings would be within that big oval at the top. And those ten in the southern area would be within that very small little circle at the bottom. And so what happened was the northern kingdoms had the southern kingdoms under subjection for some period of time, apparently, 12, 13, 14 years or so, and had some of the southern kingdoms rebelled and said, we're not paying tribute anymore. Those guys from way up north are going to come down here and tell us what we can and can't do. And we have to pay them for the privilege of living, and we're not going to do it. So that's basically what started the whole thing, where verse 1, in the days of Amraphel, king of Shinar, Arioch, king of Elasar, Chedorlaomer, king of Elam, and Tidal, king of Goim, those were the northern kingdoms, that they made war with Bera, king of Sodom, and with Bersha, king of Gomorrah, Shinab, king of Admah, and Shemeber, king of Zeboam, and the king of Bela, that is Zoar. And then a little bit further down, it mentions in verse 5, it mentions those other groups of people that were involved in the same thing. Verse 4 says, 12 years they had served Chedorlaomer, but the 13th year they rebelled. And so in verse 5, in the 14th year, he went down to squash the rebellion. And so he apparently was the dominant king of those four. This area, even though it covers quite a large area, those parts of Iraq, Iran, and Turkey, all across that map, and then that very small area which is just south of Israel and east, southeast of Israel, or southeast of the Dead Sea, is what we'd refer to as a southern area. Well, those, as far as distance is concerned, those two areas are about 150 miles or so apart. And so it was not a huge distance, but remember that they didn't have mass transit or any of that kind of stuff, any kind of vehicles. It was all basically infantry. The verse 8, the king of well, the northern kingdoms had come down and were basically just wiping everybody out as they came down. And so the king of Sodom and Gomorrah and Admah and Zeboam all came out to meet them. Apparently they said, you know, we're not going to take this lying down. You can come and whip us, but you're going to have to whip us in order to go any further. So they came out, and sure enough, they whooped them. One of the things that sort of interesting that I came across, it's only been since about 1999, I think it was, that Sodom and Gomorrah were found. When they were destroyed with the story that we'll get to a little bit later, they were destroyed. There wasn't much of anything left. And it was basically through soil analysis that the archaeologists were able to finally designate the area that they are very sure was that area. And one thing I thought was right interesting about the whole thing was that these are all referred to as kingdoms. Even Sodom and Gomorrah are called kingdoms. They have a king. And the area that Sodom occupied is about 9 or 10 acres. If you don't have any idea what that compares to, that's about half the size of Delano Park. So that's what it refers to when it was talking about the kingdom of Sodom. It's a very small, relatively small area, but it was still referred to as a kingdom, even though it was just one town or one city. It comes even clearer when go down to I thought I marked the verse. What happened was when the northern kings came down and defeated the southern kings, they were heading back home, and so they took Lot with them. Lot's possessions probably equaled as much or more than some of those kings. And so the northern kings just took everything that was of any value back with them. And so when Abram found out about it, then he went after him. And he defeated these four kings that had come down and defeated every other kingdom in between, including the five southern kingdoms plus those other nomadic tribes that were all allied together. Abraham and his crew, anybody come across the number? How many did Abraham have in his army? 317. So that may give you some idea of how big these kingdoms were. They weren't. They were just very, very small areas that, you know, just beat on each other, apparently. And whoever knocked the other one down kept them under subjection and got tribute from them until somebody stronger could knock them off. But Abram, with 317 of his men, was an army sufficient to defeat those four northern kingdoms that had beaten all of the others. So he was able to get Lot, all of their possessions, all of the people back, and that's probably a good place to start, I mean to stop, because we need to talk about Melchizedek. So we'll stop there about halfway through chapter 14 and pick up there next week.